The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart.
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes.
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
Good day. What's going on, everybody? Welcome into First Take. Hope you had a fabulous weekend. I'm Molly Karam. That is J.J. Redick. And clearly, Stephen A. missed us already because I thought it was going to be like 4 months before we saw you. And well, here you are back in the building.
It's Boston. And so that's only a 30-minute flight. So if I have an opportunity to be in New York or Boston, where do you think I'm going to choose to be? It's not like I flew here from South Beach. Let's be clear.
J.J., how we doing?
I'm good. I also was in Boston.
Yes,
game
you were.
Three.
Yes, you were.
Had a nice time.
With the little one. With the little one.
Ran into Stephen A. at the train station.
That's right.
And
that's right.
He met my 7-year-old. Knox.
That's right.
Nice.
Beautiful kid. Beautiful kid. Because you know Stevie A. loved the kids. He sure
I love
does.
It. I love it. I love it. All right, guys. Let's get to it because we have a lot of ground to cover today. The Warriors sitting pretty. One win away from returning to the NBA Finals for the sixth time in 8 seasons after seizing a 3-0 series lead over the Mavs in the West Finals. Teams that take a 3-0 series lead have an all-time series record of 146-0. The Warriors continue to dominate in the third quarter. Golden State was led by Steph Curry's 31-point effort. Curry has already scored 30-plus points 7 times this postseason. Good company. Michael Jordan and LeBron James are the only players with that many 30-point games in a single postseason at age 35 or older. MJ and LeBron both won Finals MVP the seasons they did that. Steph, talk to me.
Y'all know I hear everything. That's not the motivation, though. The motivation is the fact that we're back on the stage with the opportunity to chase a finals appearance again after, you know, 2 years of hiatus. And like I said, being back with our core, but with a new cast of characters, that's as an opportunity to do something special. So I don't need any extra motivation.
Stephen A., thus far, has this series revealed more to you about Golden State or the Mavs?
It's revealed more to me about the Dallas Mavs than it has about the Golden State Warriors. We kind of know who they are. I mean, they've proven that. We've seen the elevation of a Jordan Poole. Andrew Wiggins deserves a lot of credit, which I'm sure you'll get into. I'll leave that to you, J.J. Redick. But I got to tell you, you walk away thinking about the Dallas Mavs. Now, I would remind everybody that last night, Luka Doncic dropped 40. Mm-hmm. I would remind y'all that in this series, he's averaging about 40 on 50% shooting. Reggie Bullock, God bless him, won the Kareem Abdul-Jabbar Social Justice Award. Yes, they well deserve.
Huge crap.
If you know about his background with his family and what happened to his sister and what have you, major, major props to him. But he shot 0 for 10 last night, okay? And then you look at a guy like Max Kleber, he shot 0 for 5. Ladies and gentlemen, that's 0 for 15. 0 points on 0 for 15 shooting. What the hell is Luka Doncic supposed to do when your supporting cast shows up and virtually gives you nothing? And we're not talking about Jalen Brunson because he shows up and he gives you what he's got. Mad respect to him. Spencer Dinwiddie has shown up over the last couple of games, and he's giving you something as well. But you can't have two guys that are getting a chunk of minutes. In Reggie Bullock's case, he played 39 minutes and 58 seconds last night. That's 40 minutes. You got Kleber that played 24 minutes and 41 seconds. 0 for 15 shooting. Mm-hmm. That's really what, to me, has been exposed about the Dallas Mavericks. When their supporting cast shows up, usually in Dallas, them brothers will run you out of the building. They can beat anybody, as they showed the Phoenix Suns on the road in Game 7 when they were up by as many as 46. But when they don't show up, it's very, very glaring. And I think that's what we've seen in this series and specifically last night, which is why the Warriors have their broomsticks ready to come out. And they're about to sweep the Dallas Mavericks, unless, of course, Dallas Mavericks, these guys decide to show up for one game and show some pride and stuff like that, which I do not put past them. But this series is over, whether it's 4 or 5. It's over.
Yeah.
I'm going to agree with Stephen A. here. This is the version of the Warriors that I think we all expected. Mm-hmm. Going into this series, we thought they were the better team. They've shown that they're the better team.
Yeah.
This has revealed to me how much the Mavs need a rim protector. When they beat the Phoenix Suns in 7 games, the Phoenix Suns are a team that largely operates in the mid-range. Mm-hmm. They're bottom 5 in the league in free throw attempts, which means they're not getting to the basket. They're bottom five in the league in three-point attempts, which means they're not getting to the basket to create three-point opportunities like the Mavs do time and time again. Mm-hmm. Right now, the Warriors are averaging 50 points a game in the paint. 50 points a game in the paint. That'd be the most in any series under Steve Kerr. Time and time again, Steph Curry breaking somebody down off the dribble, layup. Time and time again, somebody breaking down Luka off the dribble, layup. They need a rim protector. And I don't know who the answer to that is. The other question that I have going forward about the Mavericks, if you decide to pay Jalen Brunson what he deserves, which is $20-plus million a year on his new contract, if you decide to do that, you are by and large bringing back this same core group. And I don't know going forward if this group has the answer to that rim protector question.
Well, I would say this to you. Not that they qualify in terms of what you're talking about as it pertains to rim protection, but the Phoenix Suns did go out and get Biombo and you know, JaVale McGee. And so if you're the Dallas Mavericks, you need a sizable body, a tall body, that obviously, like you said, can rim protect. I don't think that's that difficult to acquire if you're not requiring anything else from them. See, if you're looking at a guy like a Clint Capella and others, that's a different animal.
Right, a Clint Capella, a Rudy Gobert, somebody like that, yes.
When you give somebody like that who can do more than just rim protect, they can snatch 15 rebounds a game. They can block three shots a game. They definitely are formidable consistently on the front court. We get that. That's a different level, and you can't go out and find that. But can you go out and find a big, active body that can give you some level of resistance at a cheap price? I think that's something that you can pull off if you're the Dallas Mavericks. I just don't think it's something you prioritize because you didn't recognize that it would be such a glaring weakness. For example, when you talk about the Golden State Warriors, yes, they shoot the ball, even though I think they can shoot the ball considerably better than they've been shooting over the last four or five games. They can shoot the basketball. We know what they bring to the table. But as Barkley and Shaq and those guys astutely pointed out, on far too many occasions, we see people jacking up threes. These guys will take it to the basket. The Warriors will attack on the interior. They'll get to the hole, whether it's a Steph who's gotten to the hole now more than I've ever seen him before. We know Jordan Poole can attack the basket. Even a Klay Thompson coming back from the two-year layoff, he's attacked the basket. And so you see the level of aggression that they have because you don't have anybody formidable waiting for you on the interior for the Dallas Mavericks. You can go out and get something, and actually something will be better than what they have because they have virtually nothing on the interior defensively. And that's what you're seeing right now.
Well, it's interesting because I do think the Mavericks have good wing defenders. Dorian Finney-Smith is a great wing defender. Reggie Bullock has been really good in these playoffs guarding the basketball. Maxi Kleber is an underrated defender. Right. They just don't have anybody that's going to create a paint consequence.
Exactly.
Other than Jalen Brunson taking a charge. I'm talking like real rim protection. They don't have that
person. They don't have it.
And it's interesting to me because they do have the wing defenders, but because of the Luka hunting and because of Steph and his threat of his three-point shot, they've elected to double-team him quite a bit in this series. And so far, when they double-team him, the Warriors have shot 60%. They're 15 of 25. That's about eight times a game.
Right.
And we've seen it time and time again in the playoffs. You've got to make a decision with how you're going to guard Steph in pick and rolls, off the ball, all that stuff.
You almost have to be the Detroit Pistons from the 80s. Like Chuck Daly said, guard your man.
Right.
Don't double.
Exactly.
Because there's too many shooters.
And so here's how I look at this going forward. When they get to the finals, and they will, I think, beat the Mavericks, you're talking about two teams in the Eastern Conference who don't really have to double. And I'm not saying they won't at times, and I'm not saying Steph Curry won't have a 40 ball at some point in the finals. But their offense, their defenses are based on having multiple wing defenders, five men that can switch. And so that's where I think this finals, whoever wins the East, this final is going to be really interesting.
And both the Eastern teams are beat up, and they're probably going to have a longer series as well.
In other words, this series against Dallas is no indication of what's coming.
Fair enough. You know who else Golden State has? Andrew Wiggins just posterizing Luka last night. The dunk with Wiggins driving past Bullock before levitating and throwing it down over Doncic almost didn't count after the refs called an offensive foul on Wiggins, but they overturned the call after a replay review. Luka, what do you think about that dunk?
That was impressive, I'm not going to lie. I saw the video again, I was like, oof. That was pretty incredible, you know. I wish I had those bunnies.
Okay. Okay, better Warriors playoff dunk. Is it Wiggins or Baron Davis on AK-47 in the 2007 playoffs?
I was distracted a little bit there by Luka's watch.
That was nice.
Nice yellow gold Royal Oak. Yeah, it's nice. Very nice.
I was staring at the watch, too.
It's nice.
I'm sure you were.
He meant to put his left arm
up. But I was trying to stay focused.
Look, Wiggins dunking over Luka is not – I mean, it's an amazing dunk, and it took took me out of my seat. Oh, my gosh, that was awesome. But Baron Davis's dunk against AK-47, against Kirilenko. Kirilenko was a great defender. I mean, he's one of the few guys that would have those 5-5-5-5 games where he would have 5 blocks, 5 steals. Mm-hmm. The moment at home, at Oracle, 8 seed versus 1 seed, guard, undersized, dunking against a guy who was 6'9", 6'10", with a long wingspan. I think the moment for the Baron Davis dunk was more significant and more memorable. It was probably a better dunk, more impressive dunk.
I agree with you. There's no argument here. I mean, if you look at back then, I mean, you had a situation where obviously they were the 8th seed, Utah was a high seed. I'm just looking at Kirilenko, and you are absolutely right. He was definitely a big-time defender. We all knew this. He was considerably taller. And on top of it all, you had Baron Davis attacking the rim. And I love how you got Steven Jackson just wiping off his shoulders at the end, you know. So I love all of that. Just as big-time as this dunk was, and it was against Luka, who will never be accused of having hops. We know that Luka's got many, many things in his arsenal. Hops ain't one of them. That's not his strength, okay? And so Andrew Wiggins, being just as tall, if not taller, having some athleticism, definitely I think that I can understand how people will look at it, but Baron Davis's dunk was definitely better. Not to mention the fact, I will say this. Wiggins has been incredibly impressive.
Yeah.
This is a guy that I once thought they could have given away for a bag of cookies because he didn't do anything. He's just too demure, too quiet. Went along to get along, had the quietest 18, 19, 20 points per game you'd ever see. I thought that about him. That changed this year. The first part of the year when he ultimately earned himself as an all-star, the all-star nod, and the way that he has played during these playoffs. If you look at Andre Iguodala, and what your expectations are of him when he is healthy, look at what Wiggins is doing. Look at what he's doing on the defensive side of the ball. Not to mention, he's burying perimeter shots, including three-pointers when given the opportunity to do so. He's long, he's athletic, and he's been going after it. And it's like the Steph, the Clay, the Draymond, the Jordan Poole mentality. It sort of infused something in him where you're seeing something a little bit different from a personality perspective in terms of his assertiveness. And he's really stepped up. I've been very, very impressed with Andrew Wiggins, and he can be a difference in terms of their championship aspirations because of who they're going to go against next.
I think that what's so interesting about this is sort of the narrative around a player and what expectations as a number one pick can do to a player, what the wrong role can do around the narrative of a player. Mm-hmm. Andrew Wiggins, to me, is in the perfect situation right now. As a number one option, playing on bad Minnesota teams, that wasn't the right role for him. I go back to 2019 summer when Kevin Durant clearly going to leave the Warriors. The Warriors being able to facilitate a sign and trade. They overpaid for D'Angelo Russell. They gave him the max, but they paid him $30 million a year so that they could cash that chip in at some point. And Wiggins was the guy that they ultimately ended up getting, and he has been a perfect fit for them. Spot up threes as a cutter, so valuable. How many times this year have we seen after timeout plays where he is the screener for Steph Curry? Knowing that two guys are going to run at Steph, he slips right to the rim for a layup. And, of course, his defense and his rebounding has been really good in the playoffs as well. I just think on this team, he doesn't have to be the guy. That's not who he is. Mm-hmm. But he's so valuable as that third or fourth guy, as a big wing. And I'm really happy for him that he's been able to change the narrative around his career.
Well, I'm happy for him as well. But let's be clear. He earned it. He earned changing that narrative just like he earned the initial narrative there was out about him.
Yeah.
You see, a lot of times people walk around like, or people try to treat other individuals like they've been victimized by somebody else. No, you were victimized by yourself. You were a number one pick. You were in Minnesota. You were a bit demure. You were a bit passive. You weren't nearly as aggressive. You certainly didn't embrace the responsibility that comes along with being a number one overall pick in terms of being the face of a franchise, taking the bull by the horn and being aggressive about it. Okay, so that was what his situation was. He goes to Golden State. more specific role is required from him. He's got leaders around him. Everybody is not made of an ilk. That's not a crime. He did nothing wrong. I'm simply saying that there's an expectation that comes with being a number one overall pick. So some of the criticisms or the skepticism that was thrown out there about Andrew Wiggins, he had earned that. And now this year, he has shown that he has earned all the praise he is receiving because we get an opportunity to look at him in a different light because he is showing a level of productivity and assertiveness that we were looking for him for from him years ago.
So I'm going to disagree with that to a point just because the productivity is not there from when who he was in Minnesota.
You're looking at numbers. I'm looking at moments.
No, let me explain that for a second. So in Minnesota, he's a 20-plus per game scorer. Mm-hmm. He's a high-volume shot creator. He's inefficient. And I think that's where some of the narrative that we're talking about is created. You know, he wasn't a generational transcendent player.
Okay.
Doesn't mean he's not valuable.
Correct.
And is not a star in a different role,
correct,
which has what he has been with the Warriors. So should he have been an all-star this year? Probably in a normal year where the Western Conference is healthier, he probably doesn't make an all-star team, let's be honest. Mm-hmm. I don't know that he's that level of player like a Kawhi Leonard or a Paul George, right? Yeah. No, but listen, hold on. Right. But in this setting, he is a star in his role as a third or fourth guy. He is not a number one.
Well, we don't disagree there. We don't disagree there. But I think the way that he was playing in the first half of the season, regardless of who would have been available, I totally understand when you talk about a start as opposed to a reserve. But the way that he was playing in the first part of the season, before Clay arrived in January, the way that he was playing, I mean, Andrew Wiggins was playing lights out. He was having a spectacular earlier part of the season. We were all impressed by what we were seeing from him.
Yep.
Ready to talk the East?
Let's do it.
All right. So let's recap the Heat versus Celtics back and forth series thus far. Jimmy Butler led Miami to a game one win by becoming the fifth player in NBA history with a 40-point game in each of the first three rounds of a single postseason. The Celtics bounced back in a big way in game two by making 10 more three-pointers than the Heat and winning by 25 points for just their fifth time in playoff history. In game three, Bam Adebayo put the team on his back, leading the Heat to a win by becoming the fourth center since 1973 to lead their team in points, rebounds, assists, blocks, and steals in a playoff win. Talk about productivity. The trainer's room is busy for game four of the Eastern Conference Finals as the status for many key players on both teams uncertain. Smart, Williams, Butler, Lowry, and Hero are all questionable, Jason Tatum being the only one of the bunch that is listed as probable for tonight's game. Stephen A., do you still believe the Celtics are winning the series now that Miami is up 2-1?
Yes. I haven't budged from that one bit. I picked the Celtics to win this series in seven games, and I expect them to win this series in seven games. I think that they're the better team. That's not to throw any shade on Miami. Miami has been very impressive. We got to look at them and respect the hell out of them and what they bring to the table. Jimmy Butler is a star in this league. I was sad to see him go down and not play in the second half. But props to the Miami Heat, their culture, their coach. Mm-hmm. And Bam Adebayo stepping up the way that he did. P.J. Tucker stepping up the way that he did as well. I'm just looking at some of the guys that showed up stressed with that big time three near the end of the game. Obviously, they got guys that stepped in and said, Kyle Lowry giving you nearly 30 minutes when he had a hamstring injury and goes out there and gives you nearly 30 minutes and makes his contribution. Respect is given where it's due, and the Miami Heat are to be respected. But Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown are who they are. Marcus Smart is who he is, the reigning defensive player of the year. I thought his ankle was broke. I couldn't believe he came back. That's why I was laughing when Trae Young sat up there and tweeted, the Boston Celtics got a hell of a medical staff. That's why he said something, I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah.
Something to that effect, obviously, because we didn't expect Marcus Smart to come back. But I didn't call it TD Bank Garden. I called it TD Bank Infirmary. I mean, what the hell was going on? We started the game out, okay? Robert Williams wasn't going to play. Then Kyle Lowry had to go back to the locker room because he seemed to tweak something. Jimmy Butler goes down. Marcus Smart goes down. Jason Tatum looks like he separated his shoulder or something. He goes down and then he comes back out and the crowd roars and everything. I'm like, damn, all of these damn injuries were taking place. In the end, however, what it comes down to is that Boston turned the ball over too damn much. Jaylen Brown, to me, I believe Jaylen Brown is a star. Good brother, great player. He's a star in this league. Turned the ball over too damn much in that third quarter. That's why I called it one of the worst 40-point games I've seen. Had five turnovers in the third quarter. He got stripped about four different times by Victor Oladipo. That can't happen. And it seemed like every single turnover, JJ, that he committed was when Boston was trying to make a run. and somehow Jaylen Brown would turn the ball over, okay? And Jason Tatum had 6 turnovers, 13 turnovers with your 2 stars. That cannot happen if you're going to beat the Miami Heat. So all I'm saying is I don't believe that's going to happen too often. I think that the Boston Celtics are going to win. It's going to take 7 games, but Boston's going to go back to South Beach, and they're going to win in a game 7. That is what I believe is going to happen.
I'm going to answer the question. Was that the most physical game you've seen in the playoffs this year?
It's been so far, yes.
And I think some of that probably led to those turnovers. I still believe the Celtics are going to win this series as well. And a lot of this depends on Marcus Smart. I'm not saying Marcus Smart is the best player on the Celtics, right, but to me, he is their most important player. And that has sort of shown in this series. He missed game 1, they lose. He comes back for game 2, he goes for 24-12, they win. Game 3, so much of that comeback was because of his just grit. I mean, him coming back after that ankle injury, TD Garden erupted, and then he hit that sidestep 3. That was peak sort of playoff crowd at that moment.
Yes, it was.
And so much of their struggles to me in game 3 was a matter of pace and a little bit too much of target hunting. Mm-hmm. Going against a box and elbow set defense for the Miami Heat is not a formula for winning basketball. The Heat sort of changed their strategy. I thought having Kyle Lowry back, his throw-ahead passes, being able to get the pace going early in the game was huge. And then, bam, just being a facilitator, slipping behind screens, playing out of the short roll, dribble handoffs. The Heat felt like they made a choice in Game 3. We're going to not try to play against the Celtics' half-court defense. We do not want to go against their set half-court defense, where the Celtics, just time and time again, were going against 5 bodies. And with Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum, I thought there were a number of times where they drove, they're being aggressive, I get it, they were driving without a plan. Mm-hmm. And so many of those turnovers were created by just getting into traffic and getting into space and not really having a plan of whether or not to shoot or draw a defender and kick. Mm-hmm. It was just being aggressive to be aggressive for that sake.
Well, let me say this to you. All of that's fine, good and dandy, and I don't disagree with anything that you said. But we're not having this conversation if Jason Tatum shows up. Jason Tatum didn't show up in game 3. He had more turnovers than field goals. This is Jason Tatum we talk about here, okay? This is some people would say a superstar in this league. We've seen him put forth superstar performances, okay? But what we're waiting for is the level of consistency that he has robbed us of. We know what he can do, but are you going to do this on a continuous basis? I expect Jason Tatum to have a big game tonight because he was so putrid in game 3, okay? But he's the kind of person that'll have a big-time game tonight, drop over 40, and then go back to South Beach for game 5 and all of a sudden wet the bed again. Come back for game 6, have a big game. And then it's up in the air what's going to happen for game 7. He's got to put forth a level of consistency, and both him and Jaylen Brown have got to stop turning the damn ball over. It's really that simple. You talk about everything that you're saying. I don't disagree with a word of it. I'm simply saying that Jason Tatum is that dude. You play on your game. They walk away with this victory in game 3. Mm-hmm. Shoot 2 for 3 for 10 from the field. They ain't going to cut it. Yeah. You walk away. You show a bit more efficiency. Put up over 20, 24 points a game, all right? You're winning this game. You didn't win this game because Jason Tatum didn't show up primarily more so than anything else, especially once Jimmy Butler went down. Once Jimmy Butler went down, remember, they were down 26.
Yeah.
They pulled within 1, okay? Jimmy Butler's out. You've got them. But you got to stop turning the ball over, and that's what this comes down to for me with Boston.
I think all valid points on Tatum, and I said at the beginning of the series, so much of Celtics' success in the series will be based on his decision-making. Mm-hmm. And it's not just the turnovers. It's the shot selection. It's knowing when to go fast, knowing when to go slow. And one X and O thing I just want to point out that I saw in game 3 is the Heat in the half court, as they were coming up to set high screen and rolls, they know the Celtics are going to switch, just like the Heat are going to switch. They were able to use Bam and P.J. Tucker a bunch. Mm-hmm. They get into that pick and roll, and instead of slipping into space, they slip to the short roll, and they're getting behind the defense. The Celtics need to do more of that with Al Horford.
Okay.
Like, we can talk about movement. We can talk about play calling all you want. Basketball is a very simple game. Like, how do you create an advantage? They need to create advantages and not just go head on 2.
Yes, one more thing. Fair enough. The Boston Celtics in the first 3 games have 48 turnovers. How many do Jaylen Brown – and Jason Tatum have?
Well, you got the number in 20, front of you.
26.
I know they had 13 in game
26
three.
26
yeah.
turnovers. Yeah. 16 turnovers by Tatum in three games.
Game four tonight. 8:30 Eastern on ABC. JJ, sit tight. We'll be back with you in just a minute. Right. Stephen A., we have another subject to discuss. Sure. Controversial topic in baseball we want to get into here. Tim Anderson let his play do the talking. Anderson hit a three-run homer and then put a finger to his lips to silence fans booing and chanting Jackie at him, capping a tumultuous weekend at Yankee Stadium and helping the Chicago White Sox beat New York 5-0 Sunday night for a doubleheader sweep. A day after, Anderson, who is black, said he was offended by Yankee slugger Josh Donaldson, who is white, calling him Jackie. The exchange between Donaldson and Anderson incited a benches clearing incident at Yankee Stadium. The all-star shortstop didn't play in the first game. Here's Anderson on those incendiary comments.
He just made a disrespectful comment. Basically was trying to call me Jackie Robinson. Like, what's up, Jackie? I don't play like that. I don't really play at all. I wasn't really, bothering nobody today, but, he made a comment, and, it was disrespectful, and I don't think it was called for.
You call it disrespectful. Tony just said it was racist. Is that accurate?
Yeah, same along that same line, yeah.
All right, so first inning, I called him Jackie. So let me give you a little context of that. 2019, he came out with an interview, said that he's the new Jackie Robinson of baseball. He's going to bring back fun for the game, right? And 2019, when I played for Atlanta, we actually joked about that on the game. I don't know what's changed from... And I've said it to him in years past, not in any manner than just joking around for the fact that he called himself Jackie Robinson, if something has changed from that, like my meaning of that is not at any term trying to be racist by any fact of the matter. It was just off of an interview that what he called himself. And when we said that before, we joked about it, he laughed, whatever. Obviously, he deemed that it was disrespectful. And look, if he did, I apologize. Like, that's not what I was trying to do by any manner.
If he was joking, I'm curious why it would elicit such a response. Big Swag Goon Marcus Spears here is with us. Marcus, top of the morning to you. Good to have you. And I want to start with you here, Marcus. What is your take on this incident?
Yeah, listen, there are different ways to think about this. Donaldson taking him at his word. He was not trying to be racist or not abreast that this would be abrasive to Tim Anderson. And then there's another point, Molly. There's connotation. We all know the history of Jackie Robinson. We all know the color barrier and the stigma that still lives in Major League Baseball that they're trying to overcome. As well, when it comes to race, inclusivity, and all of those things that come along the lines with it. I don't want to try to decipher between what Donaldson meant. I just want to give him potentially why this would send the type of reaction from Tim Anderson that it would. It's because of the times we're in. It's because of the things that have transpired over the years. It's because of how sports have been involved in racial equality and taking things head on that comes along with the game. I'm not going to cast any aspersions on Donaldson because I don't know him. I don't know his heart. I don't know what he actually meant. But I know, he talked about Tim Anderson referring to himself as Jackie Robinson. We've had a long history of having to explain how black people can refer to themselves as opposed to somebody of another race. That comes into question in this particular situation as well. The part that I think sends the wrong message, the part that of why we're talking about this on First Take and wrapping up so I can let Stephen A. take the mic on this. I'm not a sensitive guy, right? Like, I'm one of those dudes, and Stephen A. knows this. He's my big bro, and we talk about this all the time. I just want to know where you stand. And I've said this to you as well, Molly Q. I just want to know where you stand on it. Mm-hmm. All right? So I know how to deal with you. I know what place to put you in. I understand the type of relationship or non-relationship that we will have. Donaldson has a responsibility to understand what calling Tim Anderson, Jackie Robinson, whether he called himself that or not, brings. That brings a type of connotation that can be misconstrued or viewed as being racist or viewed as trying to bring something up during a time when Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier of all of the things that he was going to. I don't know which one he was trying to level into. I think I have to take him at face value when he says that he was referring to a 2019 interview when Tim Anderson referred to himself as Jackie. But ultimately, the connotation that comes along with that is something that Donaldson has to understand. And he has to understand why that would elicit that type of reaction from Tim Anderson. And watching this story and listening to it, there are more incidences where guys are not fond of Donaldson in this league. I don't know if it has a racist connotation, but he doesn't seem to be an ultimately well-liked guy throughout Major League Baseball and in certain locker rooms and in certain rooms.
Subjects like this, I love embracing on this show.
Mm.
Particular incidents like this annoy the living hell out of me. Because Tim Anderson is somebody I'm incredibly fond of. Major League Baseball players, as of May of this year, 7.2% of Major League Baseball players were black. We understand that. We understand there's a paucity of African Americans in the sport. We understand that this is something that's incredibly alarming to Major League Baseball and that something needs to be done to address the limited numbers of African Americans participating in the world of Major League Baseball. We get that. So we have to understand that Tim Anderson understands that better than anybody. Knowing that he knows that, here's what upsets me about this. We are having a conversation about race. And I can't sit here and tell you that anything Josh Donaldson said was racist. I think that it's actually wrong for people to attach racism or racist to Josh Donaldson today. Or for this incident. I don't know the man at all. Never met him. Never talked to him. Don't know anything about him. I don't even know. I'm not even aware of what you said you're aware of, Marcus, that he doesn't seem to be particularly well. Like, I've got to ask the baseball aficionados that cover the sport how true that statement is. I have no idea who the man is. I mean, I've seen him play. Okay, and I saw that he came down on Anderson's arm when Anderson was trying to go back to third base, when he overran third base, rather, and was going back, and they tried to get him out of third base.
Yep.
You don't come down on his arm like that. I can look at that. But as it pertains to this particular comment being racist or invoking racism, here's where my problem lies. Tim Anderson said you had a problem with that. Well, Josh Donaldson stood before the media, no written statement, no tweet, no anything, right in front of everybody. Report, no statement issued and he disappeared and you couldn't find him looking for him. No, right in front of the media. He said, let me give you the history. And then he said that he had said this to Tim Anderson on several occasions in the past. Both of them had joked about it and it was fine. So if that's true, how come Tim Anderson hasn't talked about that? See, what I'm saying to you is this. We have to be fair. Because if you're Tim Anderson and you're addressing this subject, well, address what he said. Did he call you that before? Were you two joking about it? Did you say that in the Sports Illustrated article? Was that where this bred from? And if that is the case, were you offended by it then? Because he's saying, no, it was understood. Because why? Jackie Robinson integrated the sport of Major League Baseball, 1947. Jackie Robinson stood tall and high as an African-American that wanted to make sure he integrated the sport and assisted greatly in that. We all know what Jackie Robinson stands for. And Tim Anderson, looking at the paucity of African-Americans participating in the sport of Major League Baseball, he wants to take that position. So guess what? Did he mind being called that? We don't know. And because we don't know, and Tim Anderson hasn't enlightened us about it, now here Josh Donaldson has to deal with the fact that he's being called racist. And this is the thing, and I'm going to go back to you, Swaggoo, and Molly with this. Here's why I'm annoyed by it. We got to make sure when we make accusations like that, that it counts. It's damn near pretty irrefutable what you are.
Agreed.
Because when you leave that wiggle room for denial, it heightens a level of sensitivity that we're perceived as having. It gives others an excuse to be tone deaf to when we're making those arguments. And then when real, bona fide, undeniable, unequivocal, racist behavior is exhibited and put on display, people get to feign denials and all of this other stuff so many times we're bringing this up. I'm just saying
No.
We got to be careful.
Pause
about
for one second. One second, Swaggo, because I understand obviously you're saying pick your battle, so your argument's more potent. I get what you're saying here, Stephen A., in terms of this particular instance, right? But I want to ask you this. If Josh Donaldson had not come out and said the history and given the context about 2019, would you have been okay with this?
No, I would not have been okay with it. But my point is that's not what happened. I'm addressing what actually happened. What actually happened is that this is something he said he had been saying to Tim Anderson, and Tim Anderson took no offense at. So now if this was the first time, now listen, if he had said this and that was the first time that ever happened, I'm uncomfortable with it. I don't like it.
Yeah.
It does seem to have racial overtones, sure. But when he explained that this is what he had been saying and Tim Anderson hasn't addressed that, now I'm in no position to call Josh Donaldson out about this.
No, that's fair, but we have to hear from Tim Anderson.
But we did.
Because why was he so upset by it? Why was he so upset this time is my point. Go ahead, Marcus.
Molly, that's why I made it a point to say I'm not trying to determine Donaldson hard or what he was leading to. But I also can see why the connotation would be there. Stephen A., you make a great point. If it's been joked about between the two individuals that we've been talked about, and there has been no reason for Donaldson to think that that relationship changed, that he couldn't joke about it, then, that's so understandable because everybody has been in that particular situation. One thing I want to point out, La Russa called it racist. All right, Donaldson just said same. So he wasn't the first one to come out and respond to it and put that connotation on it. And then when Tim Anderson said same, when the reporter asked about the question, you and I align in a certain aspect of this conversation, SA. And that line is, I thought this was cool. I thought it was okay to call you that. Now, the crowd was calling him Jackie. Tim Anderson could have been in his feelings about something, and he could have taken it to a level that it shouldn't have been taken to. But I also don't want people to miss the connotation because it's important. Regardless of if you meant to offend him, regardless of if it was something that you was oblivious to because of a previous relationship, which would absolve you of thinking that was okay to go to say to Tim Anderson, ultimately, if that relationship has changed, if something has happened, if something throughout this period of time has transpired, Donaldson has a responsibility to pay attention to that, Stephen.
Yeah, but
I'm with you. If he totally didn't think that anything was wrong with it and it was from a previous relationship of calling Tim Anderson that before, there is no reason to have a visceral reaction to it.
But Marcus, here's what I think you're not bringing up. And it's not that you missed it. You're not bringing it up, but it's very, very important. These individuals were not mic'd and we heard this and this brouhaha came to be. You informed us about this. So the point that you informed us about this, why would you leave out the fact that y'all have been joking about this for years? See, that's where it gets tricky. And because that's the tricky element of it all, remember, Jackie can sit up there, if the league is 7.2% African American, and you view yourself as being the next Jackie Robinson because you're using it as an opportunity to highlight the paucity of African-American participation in the world of Major League Baseball, and somebody is calling you Jackie based off of that, then that's entirely different connotation.
Yeah.
And so for Josh Donaldson to highlight that and to explain that to me Tim Anderson has just as much of an obligation to elaborate
responsibility,
on
yeah.
what their relationship was and what that statement
absolutely.
Meant.
Absolutely, because there's some
saying.
Missing holes in the story. And again, there's three sides to every story, right? His side, her side,
hey, listen,
the truth.
Hey, listen, everybody ain't racist, but there's quite a few damn racists in this country. Ain't no question about it. All I'm saying is, when you call somebody racist, I need to be able to look and go
you
like
better
this.
Know
yeah,
it.
Yeah, 100%. That's true.
100%.
It can't be this kind of 100%. Wiggle room because you dilute real pertinent racist issues and you take the profile away from real racist. That's what you got to be careful of as a black person, in my estimation.
100%. Understand everything right there.
Hey, Molly Karam here, and thanks so much for listening to the First Take podcast. We all know breakfast is part of your day, but sometimes when you're traveling for business, you end up staying at a hotel that doesn't offer any, and you know what happens. You grab a cup of coffee, you skip the meal entirely. We've all been there. But if you book a room at La Quinta by Wyndham, you can enjoy their free Bright Side breakfast featuring delicious baked goods, fruit, eggs, yogurt, even waffles. And really, who doesn't want to start their day with a fresh hot waffle? Come on. Tonight, La Quinta, tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
Hey, hey, I'm Molly Karam, and thanks so much for listening to the First Take podcast. You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish. Yes, catch the clutch hits, strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-time chimney sweepers, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish, but you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, root, root with nothing on your roof. Yes, stream your team. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com to sign up today. Claim based on the total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Thanks so much for listening to the First Take Pod. Have a fabulous day.
First Take fans, listen up. Have you heard you can listen to episodes of this very show ad-free on Amazon Music, included with your Prime membership? That's right. All your favorite First Take episodes can be heard on Amazon Music ad-free. But that's not all. You can listen to other top podcasts like The Low Post and PTI ad-free as well. They also have favorite shows like The Daily, Part of My Take, and Up First, all without ads. You know what this means? Uninterrupted listening, so no more cliffhangers. Amazon Music offers the most ad-free top podcasts, so we know they definitely have something for you. And it's already included in your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app for free or go to Amazon.com/First Take. That's Amazon.com/First Take to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Brought to you by the Capital One Venture X Card. Earn unlimited 2X miles in everything you buy and turn everyday purchases into extraordinary trips. Plus, receive premium travel benefits, like access to over 1,300 airport lounges and a $300 annual credit for bookings through Capital One Travel. Unlock a whole new world of travel with a Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
We were second in recruiting last year. A&M was first. A&M bought every player on their team, made a deal for name, image, and likeness. All right, we didn't buy one player. All right, but I don't know if we're going to be able to sustain that in the future because more and more people are doing it. Yeah. So it's tough.
It's despicable that a reputable head coach could come out and say this when he doesn't get his way or things don't go his way. The narcissist in him doesn't allow those things to happen, and it's ridiculous. We built him up to be the czar of football. Go dig into his past or anybody that's ever coached with him. You coach with people like Bobby Bowden and learn how to do things. You coach with other people and learn how not to do things. There's a reason people don't go, I ain't went back and worked for them with opportunities.
Coach back behind
don't
the lights.
Don't be associated with it.
I haven't talked to Coach Saban. I'm pretty sure he's tried to call. But we need to talk publicly, not privately. What you said was public. That is not a private conversation. Let's talk publicly and let everybody hear the conversation.
All right, clearly a lot to unpack here. Meanwhile, former Florida head coach and Hall of Famer Steve Spurrier weighed in telling DogNation.com on Saban Fisher's war of words, I don't know why Fisher is mad at Saban. Did Saban say something that wasn't true? Marcus, obviously you played in the SEC. You've covered the SEC for quite some time. Was Saban out of line here?
Hell yeah, he was out of line. And first, everybody knows my affinity for Nick Saban and Jimbo Fisher. Got tremendous amount of respect and love for both of those gentlemen, as well as Deion Sanders, Coach Prime. So, but for Nick Saban to come out and make a statement saying Texas A&M bought every one of their players, okay, when coincidentally they ended up with the number one recruiting class, which you've been accustomed to having for the last 15 years at the University of Alabama, this has nothing to do with jealousy or somebody wanting to be Alabama or wanting to be Nick Saban. Jimbo Fisher took it as a shot, and he should have, because what the rules allow Texas A&M to do, they use to their advantage. Now, let me explain something to the audience that's watching. Nick Saban has always been the first to the party to be able to use within the rules to create advantages, whether it be in recruiting or on the football field. That's what he's done as well as anybody else in college football, which lends itself to the tremendous amount of success that he's had. But we know what type of connotation goes along with saying a program bought players. All right, let's not have a conversation like we're oblivious to what that actually means and how that looks. If Nick Saban would have said Texas A&M had a collective, and I don't know the full definition of collective. I think it's a sum of money that you can use for NIL deals for players that you bring. Mm-hmm. If he would have explained how you can have an advantage within how the structure of college football is right now, I don't think anybody would have a problem with it. But if I say that a university bought players, what type of damn connotation y'all think that's going to have to the public? Coming from the most visible, recognizable face in college football, the guy that everybody deems as the guy that carries the torch for the game, like Jimbo Fisher said. And on the other end, Prime, Coach Deion Sanders at Jackson State got Travis Hunter to come play, the number one player in the country, who plays defensive back and wide receiver, and he's going to go play with the greatest defensive back to ever play in the NFL. Why don't we mention that as being a part of the reason that he went to Jackson State, HBCU? If he got $1 million, so what? If it was within the rules and the structure of where the NIL is right now, so what? You have the same ability to do that at the University of Alabama. This was bad. And as much as it's well documented, the affinity and the love that I have for Nick Saban. It's well documented, the affinity and love that I have for Jimbo Fisher. Deion Sanders, Coach Prime, I consider a mentor, somebody that I seek a lot of wisdom from when I have the opportunity to be around him. For him to call out those two specific individuals, one who he's done athletic commercials with and one who he's coached with, and I was on the team that won a national championship where Jimbo Fisher played a hell of a role. He was the guy that was more prevalent in my recruiting to come to LSU. He was a big reason that I decided to go there, along with Coach Nick Saban, who's phenomenal. But this was bad by Coach Saban. And I think it was more of a ploy and a plea to his boosters to up whatever they could do within the confines and the structure of what they want to do. But this was totally tasteless. It was poor to say that they bought players. First of all, that's a whole nother lane we can go down. And the second thing is, when you come out and talk about an assistant coach who helped you get to where you are, as well as you helped him get to where he is, and then Deion Sanders, Coach Prime, who's had the type of cachet and responsibility to football in general, not to mention going back to HBCU to try to elevate the profile of that conference and put attention on those programs, it was all around bad. And I would tell Nick Saban that on a phone conversation or to his face. It was not good to say.
You're not wrong, but it goes deeper than that. And that's what we're going to address right now. I love me some Nick Saban. Ain't no question about that. I've spoken to him on several occasions over the years. I gave a speech to his football program on at least two occasions. I revere the man. but I'm incredibly fond of Jimbo Fisher as well. And this man can coach too. And Texas A&M is a fabulous university because I've spoken there as well. It's a sensational university. Make no mistake about it. With deep pockets, they coming. Okay, some Jimbo Fisher, somebody, if he don't, somebody gonna get it right. I'm telling you, they're special. Nick Saban made a huge mistake naming their names.
Yes, he did.
Jimbo Fisher is a coach that played that coached under you. You had no business doing that. And you don't really want to get into an argument with primetime Deion Sanders. I mean, good luck with that one. Good luck with that one. So, I mean, Nick Saban really, really made a mistake. Here's what I think you're missing. I think as he reflects on it, he knows he made a mistake by mentioning those two programs, those two names.
Yeah.
But I think also mission accomplished. Marcus Spears, Nick Saban's issue is not those programs. His issue is NIL and name, image, likeness. And it's not about alerting the boosters like you just highlighted. I think Nick Saban is upset that not enough coaches are speaking out against NIL and the impact that it's having on college football. So let's highlight what that is. You have a situation where, according to what I've been told and what I've read, name, image, and likeness was obviously a way in which athletes could ultimately profit off of, obviously, their name, image, likeness, okay? And what you were supposed to do, you're allowed to hire an agent, and what you were supposed to do was capitalize off your name, image, and likeness and monetize that somehow, some way outside of the football program. What you weren't supposed to do, according to several coaches that I'd spoken to, is essentially blackmail programs into giving you more money. Because when you do that, now it's made the situation a far more salacious than anybody ever anticipated. You were supposed to use an agent to go outside the corridors of a football program and to go to various businesses where you could capitalize monetarily off your name, image, and likeness. But what you have, according to the coaches, and it's fairness to all the agents out there, I haven't spoken to them about that yet, I will, but some coaches are saying, Swagoo, that the agents are using them to say, to pit one program against the other. So the program can find a way through its alumni, et cetera, to funnel money to these players. They consider that extortion. I've had two coaches in on a collegiate level use the word extortion. And so if you're a guy like Nick Saban, who's a seven-time, I want to remind everybody, this is a seven-time national champion. This is a man that is considered the ultimate winner in the history of college football. He could retire today, and he is the first name on the Mount Rushmore of college 100%. Football. So for him to speak in the way that he did, he was wrong to bring up Texas A&M and Jimbo Fisher. He was wrong to bring up Jackson State and primetime Deion Sanders. But the overall point he's trying to make is this NIL issue in college football is deteriorating this game.
Stephen
and
we need
but
hold
everybody
back
already
up. Marcus,
knew
Marcus,
that.
Marcus,
already...
we're going to revisit in the second hour. You'll be back and you can respond to that, the extortion subject and all of it. We'll be right back.